Here we go. Welcome everybody to the G&T sessions. Gerda, Mala, Tess, Crawley, G&T. We started this podcast a while back as a bit of a fun idea to get really an excuse just to get the two of us together because we do love to hang out. And Gerda lives at one end of Australia and I was living right at the bottom end. Now, of course, I'm not quite so far south. But now, of course, we're finding that our combined audiences, our combined communities, and needing more than ever insights into how to handle some of the stuff that we're finding ourselves tangled up in around running a private practice, running a business during the era of COVID-19. So we thought we might talk a little bit about that today. How are you, Gerda? I hope you haven't frozen.
I can't hear you.
You can't hear me? I can hear you. I can hear you. I'm not muted, but I can hear you.
I'm going.
There you are. Oh, can you hear me?
Hello.
There you are.
Yeah, I couldn't hear you there for a bit. You were going.
Oh, no. I think we've got a dodgy internet connection.
I'm not sure with mine. Maybe our people can. Yeah, that's better.
Yeah. See how we go. See how we go. All right.
Okay. Fabulous.
What do you want to fill us in on this week?
Yeah, I like.
I'm going to put the spotlight on you.
Just said, you know, I missed everything that you just said. So
we've just been talking about the wonders of technology.
Okay, all right.
But what I was saying really was that you know, the podcast, the need for the podcast, or the reason, or the rationale for the podcast, has shifted a little bit. Now it's an opportunity for us to get together and sing from the same song sheet with all of the troubles that people are experiencing in running their businesses during the era of COVID-19. Everybody has had a bunch of weeks that have felt like years, but I think you and I in particular have had, you know, a lot of need to be very present for people, especially private practitioners, in the last couple of weeks with ever shifting rules and obligations as we move forward. How's your experience of that been?
Yeah, it's probably very similar to your own. And I think the challenge that a lot of people have is the fact that there's so uncertainty and there's a lot of decision making that needs to happen. And people are just so darn scared to make the wrong decisions. And they ask everybody else what they need to do when very often it's a very individualized decision, because our businesses might have a lot of similarities, but there's also a lot of differences, right? And then people get stuck into, I don't know, is it procrastination? They're just not making a decision because they don't know what the right thing is to do, right?
That's it.
So it's really, really hard. And I mean, I, for one, always grateful that I have somebody that thinks very similar to myself and yourself, and the two of us can bounce stuff off one another. And I guess that's why we want to talk about the things we talk about, why we want to talk about the issues we want to talk about today, to also share that with other people that might not be in a similar situation, because there's a trust in this relationship as well, right? There's a honesty, there's a transparency, there's a vulnerability, and all this combined knowledge and experience. So it's like when I ask you for input and advice, and it's like, yeah, I can go with that, right? I don't need to have that confirmed by 120,000 other people. I only need to hear from this one person, and that just makes it so much easier, right? And it's my hope that we can help our communities with that this morning by having this discussion.
I think so. I think probably now more than ever, I think people need to really be connected with people they trust and with people whose opinions and advice they trust. I think one of the things that I've noticed that does concern me a little bit, we've always seen this in Facebook groups and things like that, is where someone will post a question and there'll be a lot of answers that are, I think this and I think that, and then there'll be a lot of other commenters, but what about this, but what about that? And you get a sort of a minestrone soup kind of answer instead of a pure essence of beef answer.
Yes.
And I think in days like this, if you're a member of somebody's group, whether it's mine or Gerda's or whoever it is, if you're a member of a group that has a strong leadership, like has someone at the helm of that group driving the culture, I think if you're asking questions in that group and you specifically want to know a clear answer, I think it's really important to tag the group owner, because I think you're probably the same, Gerda. I don't get notifications of everything that happens in my group. That's a change that happened with Facebook groups a long time ago, or seems a long time ago. I don't know why. I used to get notified whenever anything happened in one of my groups. Now sometimes it's a bit hit and miss. So I think the first thing I would be saying to people finding advice or seeking advice online is, if you're in a group of someone you trust, then ask the group owner, tag them in a question. If it's a really important question that needs a really clear answer and you know that they are likely to have that information for you, then tag them, just to be sure that they don't miss the question. I know certainly you and I, Gerda, we're very, very keen to reduce confusion in our groups, maintain a culture within our groups. We've both got groups that are, you know, I think both of us actually are very lucky in that the groups that we have a beautiful tone to them. And of course you and I are equally willing to answer any questions posed in that group if we see them, but we don't always see them. It's probably the first thing. The first thing I've noticed this week is just that level of fear and that increased chatter within groups, with a lot of confusion thrown into the mix because everyone's anxious at the moment, which is understandable.
It's understandable. Yeah, and the thing is, it just makes it then harder. You know, you go into a group, you ask a question, hoping to get some clear direction, and you get all these different opinions, right? And it's like, oh, that makes it worse. What do I do?
And I think this is why, you know, groups like ours exist, because they're many times, you know, a question might be asked and the answer, there might not be one right answer. There might be an opinion. And we've seen an example of that this past week, I think, with the Australian Psychological Society expressing an opinion within a webinar about billing practices within private psychology practices in particular. And I think what's been really important that you and I've conveyed to our audiences is that's their opinion. It isn't that, you know, what they had to say is not documented in our code of ethics, and it is not documented in the legislation around Medicare, that we must apply Medicare item numbers if a mental health care plan exists. That's not a rule. That was an opinion made on the fly by two very tired, hardworking women at the very end of a webinar late-ish in the evening. So I think that has to be taken context. Opinions aren't always right answers. So sometimes you do have to wade through a lot of opinions and then come up with your own decision. And I think that's where a lot of people are scared, because we are now having to make a lot of our own decisions. So people in private practice who've always bulk billed, that's a decision they made to suit their business, and if that makes sense financially for their business, that's fine. That's their decision. People who've never bulk billed, that's a business decision they've made, and there's no judgment between those two decisions. Whatever is right for your business. I know if I bulk billed everyone in my practice, I would have to fire people whose bulk billing rate was so low it wouldn't cover their salaries. So, you know, it's a business by business decision, and it comes down to a client by client conversation as well.
And the thing is, you know, I've always said, you know, hats off to you if you decide to have a bulk billing practice. If that was me, I would probably change my company structure to a non-for-profit so I can have all the other benefits that comes with being a non-for-profit, right? But I think it would be really hard to run a for-profit, scalable, long-term sustainable business if you're going to bulk bill. And you, of course, then run the risk, which I'm not willing to take, of burning out your team, right? And of course, with everything, there comes consequences. Maybe, you know, you can feel good about saying that I bulk bill people and I'm being really, you know, good in that way. But what about your other people, right? Our clients, people, and our team people are equally important. You know, and I don't judge people that wanted to have a bulk billing practice, but I expect the same courtesy in return, right? So, yes. And of course,
it's been a hot topic all week. It's been a very hot topic all week.
yes. And of course, with yesterday's announcement by the ABS, which has been confirmed this morning, there's been an MBS fact sheet release with you know, all the new billing requirements and conditions. And I'm sure everybody knows about it. But to be clear, of course, if you're now using your telehealth item numbers for anybody except those in the vulnerable category, then you can use your normal billing practices, i.e. charge a full fee and the client can get a rebate. But now, of course, that's good news. Let's just acknowledge, you know, that's awesome. That's amazing. That's better than it was last week for a whole subsection of clients, community members, and practice owners. But now we have this other subsection, a very important subsection of our private practice community, especially the pediatric private practices that work with kids, that are now told that you have one of two choices. You either need to bulk bill your clients or they're all going to be out of pocket. Okay.
Yes, without and a rebate at all for Medicare. Yeah.
So,
and it makes no sense. I mean, there's a number of areas of practice that are directly, you know, geriatric practice, health psychology, child psychology, perinatal psychology. There's a number of areas of practice where, you know, clients who are used to paying an out-of-pocket expense, they're able to still pay an out-of-pocket expense, and this blanket rule doesn't take into account individual circumstances. And I think it's really important to add, all private practitioners have the ability to take individual circumstances into account and do so. You know, that's never, ever been a question. It's when we've got blanket rules that shift the viability of a practice overnight, which is what this rule has done for a lot of I think the pediatric private psychology practices have been the most vocal to date. And understandably, their whole practice is built around a population that has had parents, working parents, paying privately for these sessions. And now the government said, just on a whim, it must be bulk billed. It sounds very much that GPs have had for a while, so family doctors have had for a while, the ability to access an incentive payment for bulk billing. And so they get extra money on top if they bulk bill these specific populations, which are the same populations, coincidentally, that have been included in this latest change from government. So whether that means, and I would love this to be the case, but whether that means we're on track to eventually have bulk bill incentives for this population or not, the fact remains that right now it's made it very, very difficult for a number of practices to remain viable. Like you say, it's almost like it's a black and white decision. You either bulk bill, so run at a loss and bulk bill, or don't offer a rebate from Medicare at all, and then it's a difficult conversation with your client. Obviously there are shades of grey, and that's probably something we can talk about today, which I've been talking about with my groups a bit, these shades of grey, really.
And it's hard, right? I know the government is trying to be helpful and supportive, but it puts private practice owners in a really difficult position where really they are having to choose between keeping their doors open potentially and how hard or difficult it might be or how long they will have versus servicing their clients, right? It's really tough choice that they are expecting them to make, and I think that's where all this angst is coming from.
That's right.
Because you know, these decisions that we are making need to pass our moral judgment test, right? You want to be able to sleep at night, knowing that not only are you looking after your clients, but you're looking after your team and their families, and you know, helping them keep a roof over their heads. And that's why the moral injury there is like really significant, and people are struggling with that right now.
That's it. I think it's a little bit like if you think of a restaurant, I often think about this with restaurants, and this is why we've seen so many restaurants toy with the idea of takeaway and delivery and then decide perhaps to close their doors and ride it out. And I think the JobKeeper initiative is such a godsend for restaurants and other hospitality industries. But you think of a restaurant, what does it cost a restaurant to open their doors? Because it's not just tables and bottoms seated at tables. It's how many people do they need in the kitchen to run certain equipment, to who does the sauces, who does the preparation of the meat, who does the desserts, who does all the different specialized things within the kitchen. So it costs a restaurant a ton of money just to open the door, just to have the people in the kitchen preparing everything, which they have spent hours being paid to prepare before a single customer walks in the door. So it would be very much like the government stating that, okay, restaurants, you're allowed to stay open, but you must charge the same price as McDonald's. That's an analogy that I think probably holds true for group practice owners at the minute.
Yeah.
If you're a group practice owner, you have to pay your staff to turn up, whether a client walks in the door or not, being told equivalent of you have to charge the same as McDonald's, so you have to bulk bill. And you've got all the admin staff and all of the other people involved, let alone your rent and your running costs and all of that sort of stuff. I think, you know, there's a sentiment in the community that everybody is taking a hit, everybody's experiencing losses of some sort or another. I've told you before, you know, my husband's lost his work as a result of the current circumstances. The interesting thing is that, you know, mental health is included as one of the essential services, but still required to take such a big hit. So my advice is to be flexible in how you approach billing with each of your clients, to have a conversation about what they can afford to pay you, to develop. I've never used a sliding scale in my practice, but I would now be open to a conversation with each client on a case-by-case basis about what they could afford to pay for this session. And if that changes, we'll have another conversation down the track. I think we really need to be, we need to remove some of the blinkers around what we've had as policies before. And now the policy really needs to be about flexibility, because that works better for the practice owner and the clinician as much as it does for the client, knowing that there's some flexibility and some room to move, rather than it's either one or the other. I think we need to find the shades of gray in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of comments in Facebook groups where people say, I must now bulk bill, I'm not going to have a choice, right? Or my clients won't come. And that's like, you know, when I read that, I feel very sad. It was just like, you know, you're giving up. And I know why, you know, it's hard. It feels like you've got no control and, you know, or you need to do all this stuff that maybe really grates against you, right? In terms of knowing, because we've got so much empathy for our clients in terms of knowing what they might be going through. You know, but at the end of the day, I 100% see what we do as an essential service. As a business owner, I also know it's my job to ensure that this essential service continues to be out here in the community, whether it's still continuing a limited number of face-to-face sessions with all the appropriate social distancing as per the government guidelines, whether it is online, this essential service needs to be around for as long as possible, right? And I'm constantly telling people, also reminding myself, that this is not the time to be short-sighted, right? So we need to be making decisions whilst, yes, getting through this very difficult period right now of constant change. So that's where the flexibility comes in, but still knowing that all of the decisions I make today, how does this feed into me still being here in 3 months, in 6 months, in 12 months? Because guess what? The consequences of all of this stuff is going to continue beyond the next six months, right? The mental health impact of it, the relationship and all of those impacts is still going to continue. So it is essential that we as an essential service remain here. And therefore, for me, it would be really hard to close my business down. That would, for me personally, that would really grain against, you know, what my personal vision for my practice is, and for myself as a helping professional, which might be different for others, right? And I think that's another important thing, that whatever decision each person makes, it's okay, right? For some people, stepping back and closing the doors and going, okay, this is my rent, you know, maybe that's all I need to look after right now. Maybe I'm a solo practitioner. Maybe that's in my best interest. So it's really about what's going to get you through this, you, your family, and then if you have a team, your team as well, right? And knowing that whatever you decide, it's not a failure.
That's it.
Your team's right decision.
I think it's really important. There's no wrong answers if it works for your business. And not only that, you are not wrong if you change your mind. You are not a bad business owner if you change your mind. In fact, I talk about this a lot. I think as a business owner, you need to be flexible. You need to be fleet-footed. You need to be able to hop from one side to the other and change your balance as is required. Mm-hmm. And so, in fact, it's an example of strength and good business ownership when you recognize that something has changed and you need to adapt accordingly. So to change your mind, it's okay if what you decide today is right for today and then tomorrow it's no longer right, you're allowed to change your mind and implement a different approach. And I think the key to all of that is actually communication with your clients. And I think no matter what business sector you're in, communication with your customers or your clients is so important. And just reflecting back, it's becoming a cliche, but we are all in this together, and none of us knows what next week's going to look like, let alone next month. And so we're going to approach this a day at a time, a week at a time. One day we might be able to say a month at a time. But we also, as business owners, do need to, whether you're a business owner with a business of one or a business of many people, you need to be flexible in the now, but you also need to have a bit of a longer term vision so you can see roughly where you're heading, even if it's just, I'm committed to the idea of staying open.
Yeah.
And I am committed to the idea of seeing myself in 6 months, 12 months time, still running this business. Yeah. If that's all you can see right now, that's enough to try and hold you steady so that the decisions you make now are strategic rather than reactive. And I think that there's a lot of reactive decision making going on at the moment, which is really quite understandable. And people are afraid of being wrong. And I think it's really important that we just hose ourselves down and be a bit kinder to ourselves and allow that flexibility and generosity that we would encourage our clients to practice, self-compassion, all of those things.
Yes, most certainly. I mean, I've become very mindful of the language that we are using at the practice, both with clients and also with our team and with ourselves. Like, at this time, this is what we're doing, right? Because that might change tomorrow. Yep. It's like, at this time, this is the policy. At this time, this is what we're using and this is what we're doing, right? Because I, for one, I personally don't like going back on my word, right? But I know that it's essential right now, that behavioral flexibility. And for me, it's just made me more comfortable going, at this time, this is the decision that we've made based on the information at hand, right? Because that's what we're doing right now. We are trying to make the best decisions based on the information at hand right now. Once that information changes, we might need to make new decisions, and that is okay as well, as you've just said.
Absolutely right. And in fact, we need to actually embrace the necessity to do that, I think. So I think that we need to prepare ourselves. If we're used to running things a certain way, we need to prepare ourselves to be doing things a different way on a day-by-day basis. I'm challenging people to even, you know, question whether or not they are communicating with their clients about where they're at right now. Does your client actually need a 50-minute session right now when they can't even find somewhere confidential to have a 50-minute conversation with you? The number of clinicians I'm hearing talking about their clients doing telehealth from their car because it's the only place where they can talk privately. So it might even be that what your client needs right now to hold them steady during this changing time until we do find a new normal, they might just need a 15-minute check-in with you every week. And you can bill for that. You can't use Medicare for that, but you can bill for a 15-minute phone conversation if that's what's keeping your client feeling steady while we settle into a new normal. And that's not the sort of thing. Lawyers are really good at that. Lawyers are really good at billing for their time. We are not. And we need to be better. We need to make decisions. If we want to run viable businesses, we need to stop assuming that everything's a 50-minute session and it's either bot billed or it's not. You know, there's so many different shades of grey that we just leave unexplored, well, many colours, let alone grey, that we leave unexplored because we've been sort of, I guess, lulled into a habit of practice. From a clinical perspective, certain therapeutic modalities require a number of boxes to be ticked before they're what we would call evidence-based. But at the moment, checking in with your client for a 15-minute conversation to see that they're keeping their head above water and to just remind them of the coping strategies you've already taught them, that might be all they need, or some of them need right now. So finding out from your client what they need right now and how you can best meet them where they're at will also educate you a little bit about what you can do differently that supports your clients going forward, at least for now.
Exactly. You know, because if you think about it, if you're doing 15-minute sessions, you can't use rebates anyway. So you can do non-Medicare mandated work, right? What people probably need is just supportive person-centered therapy, you know, a listening ear, unconditional positive regard, you know, all of that type of stuff. That's what they need, that relationship stuff, somebody to connect with and just talk to and debrief with. So, and again, it's meeting our clients where they're at, right? And supporting them in that way. But it starts with us stepping out of the mindset, the little box of how things work, and it how is uncomfortable until you've done it a couple of times, and then it's all had, right? And you should be very proud of yourself if you are innovating. And I think what often happens is we are so scared that other people are going to go, oh my God, you're doing 15-minute sessions, you can't do that. It's like, you can do whatever the hell you need to, as long as it's legal, you know, ethical. You
are as long as you and the client have an agreement that this is what you're going to do for now.
Yeah.
You know, if the client is just needing that little steadying, you can enter into text-based communication, SMSs, if you and your client agree to that. And you and your client can agree to what that costs. You know, it might be that you charge them, you know, X amount of money per text message, or it might be that you charge them an amount per week for a daily check-in or a daily back and forth. You can make up the rules around how you bill for something like that with whatever you're comfortable with and whatever, you know, ticks off on the need to bill for your time appropriately. Just because it's not linked to Medicare doesn't make it wrong. And I think that's where, you know, I've been in practice here in Australia since long before Medicare. So I think that what I've seen is that, you know, over the last over 10 years of Medicare in Australia for psychology and the other mental health professions, I've seen it actually has boxed clinicians into what they think is a reasonable use of their time or how their time should be spent.
Yeah.
We need to take those blinkers off. We really do need to take those blinkers off. I'm hearing a number of clinicians saying they might not go back to using Medicare at all. And that's a decision that you're also allowed to make. You're absolutely allowed to make that decision.
Because it's the same with the whole thing of clients only get 10 sessions. No, they don't. They can have as many sessions as they want, right? Medicare supports 10. But a lot of people then, if they work within the Medicare setting, they then only do 10 sessions with their clients, when 20 might be indicated because, God forbid, the client has to pay out of pocket. But their mental health is important enough, right? Yeah. And the government can't fund everything through Medicare. Yes, there's, you know, there's NGOs and all of that type of thing. But for private practice, we're in a different sector of the market. And we need to also know what our job is. And it's our job to look after this part of the market. We can't be public mental health. We can't be the NGOs unless you are an NGO, right? And really stepping into who we are as a private practice and owning that and not being ashamed to say that we are a for-profit business. And let's be clear, people are not right now for-profit. They just want to break even and keep their doors open. But as a general rule, there's no shame in that. The majority of other businesses out there are for-profit businesses. And why should we be judged any differently to them, right? And you know what? We're often within our own ranks that judgment come from.
Oh, absolutely.
That part.
And I think, you know, when you look at some of the Facebook groups, so if we think about psychologists specifically, just for the minute, just to use them as a simpler example, and we've got a lot of Facebook groups, so there might be a clinical psychology interest group, or there might be a health psychology interest group, or there might be an interest group that's geographically linking psychologists together. Not everyone in that group is going to be in private practice. And I think that that's something that a lot of private practitioners, when they're asking for advice within those groups, don't necessarily realise that not everyone in that group is in private practice or owns a practice or has ever owned a business or necessarily has even been in practice at all. So some of them would be, you know, academic, and that's fine. But just know the group you're in and be mindful that some of the advice you're receiving from some of those groups might not be from people who actually know the ins and outs of running a private practice and how hard and tricky it can be. I want to touch base on that issue of profit, you know, and I think that most people think profit is, you know, profit, it's like this mythical beast, you know, that and this mythical thing that exists. Most businesses, when they've got a profit, it's actually going back into the business in some way or another. I've used the analogy this week that if you think of an employee, the profit that an employee gets from being employed is paid holidays and paid sick leave. The profit that a practice owner gets is sometimes, if they're lucky, some paid sick leave and some paid holiday pay. They should get all of that stuff. But most businesses don't run enough of a profit to support practice owners taking or business owners taking paid leave. Most profits actually in some way or another go back into the businesses in some form. It might be paying for professional development. And all of those things can be budgeted for and still allow room for a profit, which could be money put aside for a rainy day, or it could be for the practice owner as a reward for all the risk and stress that they've had. But if you charge accordingly, you can start including more and more and more of those things in your budget through line items and still have a separate line item for profit. But most businesses don't. And that's the struggle. Most businesses don't. So we talk about being for profit. It's almost like we really, what we're saying is we're in favor of profit. It would be nice if we all had some.
And
that's what we should be aiming for.
Making lots and lots of profit, we would have been much calmer during this whole process because you would have all this profit in your profit coffers somewhere sitting there, and you would go,
a little vault where you've got all your jewels in one pile over here and your piles of golden coins over here and you've got your golden cups over here and little crown in the back. It is like a mythical beast.
Like 99% of people don't have that because a lot of people are building and scaling their business. And when you're in the building expansion phase, you are reinvesting that money back into it, right? So it's like people think it's there, but it's not. And sometimes it might be, let me tell you this, on your balance sheet or your profit and loss statement.
Oh, I know that.
Then you're like, where the hell is the actual money, right?
And these were always, you know, these have always been my favorite conversations with my accountant, you know, because, you know, you do show across the course of a whole year. If you're running a business, well, yes, you will show a profit. But being a small to medium business or a micro business, if you're a solopreneur, you're going to have good months and bad months and in the middle months and then amazing months and then, oh my God, really terrifying months. So our annual profit is what would happen if you evened everything out nice and into a nice predictable straight line. But that's not the reality. It's very, very up and down, very unpredictable. I often say, you know, business is it's a roller coaster. It's not a carousel. It doesn't go sedately around in circles. It goes up and down and around and the twist, the loop, all sorts of unexpected business. But most entrepreneurs, I was having this conversation yesterday with Evan Carmichael in Canada. Most entrepreneurs are, you know, we're interesting characters, you know, business owners, we're interesting characters. We're not satisfied with most of us, not satisfied with the same day in, day out, day in, day out, day in, day out. Otherwise we would have, you know, I don't know, worked for a bank or a post office or driven a tram or something that was very predictable and same-ish day in, day out. To own your own business, you're basically signing up for the ups and the downs. And this, what we're experiencing now, for many, many business owners, is their first crisis in business.
Yeah.
So for those of us who've had crises in business before, we've earned a few scars, a few stripes, it actually does inform how we handle this particular crisis, even though this is like nothing we've ever seen before. So if this is your first business crisis, kind of try to embrace a little bit of a badge of honor, because this is you earning your stripes as a business owner, having faced a crisis and committing to coming through the other end, because we're all cheering for you to come out the other end as well. You know,
it's exactly. And, you know, having gone through previous crises, we know that you can get through it.
You do get through it.
You know, it happens and you'll be okay at the end of it. And it's about trusting the process and trusting that every day you are doing your best to make the right decisions with the information you have. And that's the only way to get through this.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So I think, you know, my tips for people at the moment are to, on an individual level, a bit more self-compassion and, you know, and flexibility. So being okay with changing your mind if what's working today isn't working tomorrow, because it's bound to happen. I think on a bit outside the individual level, you know, seek support from people who know what they're talking about. Join the groups that have strong leadership with a strong culture so that you know that there's somebody at the helm who's actually behind the scenes doing research on your behalf. And I think keep communicating. I had a lovely meeting this morning with my team in Tasmania, and we're going to have the plan is a fortnightly Zoom call. And I said to them, look, if we need to go to weekly just because of the connection, because they're all working from home and two of them are in rural locations, so they're really, you know, isolated from the team geographically as well. I said to them, you know, if we need to meet weekly just to keep that connection going during this really tricky time, and I don't care if we don't even talk about work right now, if that's what you want to, if that's what you need, then that's all you need to do. And that might not be the case. That might not be what they need today, but it might be in a month or 3 months' time when it's all starting to lose its novelty and we're thin.
It is very important. Very, very important. Okay. Communication with the team and with the clients, and you did touch on it, but the earlier point that I think we just need to put a little line underneath it is when you are in groups where they are non-private practice people telling you what to do in your business, do not listen to them, please. I'm going to be very straight. Do not listen to them. I've got no standing to advise somebody that's an academic on how to do their job. Right, because that's not my job, it's not my career. And really, they shouldn't be telling you how to run your practice when they've got no idea. It's their opinion, they're allowed to express it, but I most certainly won't be making my business decisions based on that. Definitely not.
I think linked to that too is I've been encouraging people this week to just be a bit more judicious about what they're consuming on social media, and to maybe even if it's only temporarily, just trim back what you're following, because there are so many conflicting opinions. So maybe, you know, trim back what you're listening to and what you're following to be more in line with sources that you know are coming from a place of research and knowledge. And by research, I mean, you know, they're keeping on top of what's really important and relevant for you and your business. Because there's so much information out there at the moment. I know Celeste Barber was talking the other day about some of her Instagram stories got pulled by Instagram because they initiated this drive to remove things that weren't specific, that were mentioning COVID-19 but weren't coming from authorized sources. Instagram was pulling them. And she had done some stories around delivering pizzas to frontline workers at the hospital and they didn't go. They got pulled because she'd mentioned
COVID. Wow.
I think they've probably sorted that out a bit more now, but there's just too much information. I get six notifications. I'm following so many news because I don't want to miss anything from the health minister at the moment. So I'm following a couple of trusted news sources, and then I'll end up with six notifications at once when the health minister is live, you know, and it's like, yeah, probably need to cull that and follow my own advice. Just maybe pick one or two.
You'll get advice. You'll get the advice, and then you put everything else off whilst you're watching and processing, right? Because yeah. The fact of the matter is, everybody has an opinion currently on this COVID-19 thing, right? And you need to listen to the reputable sources and get it straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
So I do hope this was helpful to everyone. Did you have any other comments and stuff on your one? I can't see any comments on
here. There were some comments, but I can't see them on my iPad. So what I might do, I might close down the podcast episode. Thank you for joining us on the podcast. If you're listening later, what we're going to do is we're now going to have a look at the questions that are on the Facebook live stream. So if you want to jump from the podcast and go to the live stream recording that will remain on Facebook, you're more than welcome to do so. So thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.